Now to the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Welcome, gentlemen. David, to you first. That was quite a report from William Brangham, two towns in Texas, two groups of people, both sides of the political aisle. What does it tell you about just how divided this country is?
Yeah, welcome to life in America these days. For those of us who have been traveling around, that's reality. And two things strike me. The first is politics is based on social identity. And so, again, there's going to be differences between rural and urban and between left and right. But what's at the core? Why is the chasm so wide between the two? And why are the two universes almost non-overlapping? Whether we're just in-group, out-group, or is there some cultural or ethnic or racial divide that's at the bottom of this? It's very hard to figure out what unconsciously is making people so fervently in one universe or the other. But whether it's an identity politics thing or just that we like to form groups and we like to unify our group by hating some other group, that's the world we're in.
And Mark, they couldn't have been more divided than they were.
They weren't. I mean, they were characteristically Texan. They were outspoken. They didn't hide their allegiance or their enmities. And I thought the particular act of fraternal love was disabling the Fox News channel when his brother came to visit over Christmas. Not exactly a loving act, it would seem, but something that he boasted about to William on national television.
Well, what all of them are reacting to is what's been going on here in Washington, David, certainly during the campaign. But since we heard them saying they love the ones who like Donald Trump, they love his cabinet picks, they like his staff. But during this past week, the president's had a rough go of it, certainly losing his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, being forced out. And then the man the president wanted to have replace him announced publicly that he wasn't going to take the job. What do you make of how the president did this week?
Yeah, to me, the big chasm of the week is the gap between the circus act and the substance. The press conference was its own thing. It's like some exploding nebula of madness. I thought it was just mildly deranged, just the epitome of nonlinear thinking, let's put it that way. But what strikes me is we've got to remember, what is the guy actually doing? And here we have an administration where he's making a lot of press conferences, but on the substantive picks, he doesn't have a national security advisor. There are 691 confirmable positions in the White House. The Trump administration has not even come up with names and nominees for 631 out of those 691. So there's nobody there, nobody in the shop, no policy making being made. And so I compare it to Trump is sitting on the control deck of the Starship Enterprise, and he can push a lot of pretty buttons, but those buttons aren't connected to anything. And so nothing is happening.
And Mark, what's getting the attention, though, I mean, David may be right, but what's getting the attention is what the president was saying this week and this very public departure of his national security advisor, one of any president's closest advisors, Michael Flynn.
And certainly one of this president's closest and most loyal supporters. I mean, he spoke at the convention that and was in consideration for vice president. So this wasn't just a late connection. And the irony to me, Judy, was that Michael Flynn, the reason for his leaving was not that he had misled the vice president about his conversations with the Russian ambassador, about sanctions or possibly sanctions and retaliation, but the fact that the president knew about it, had been informed about it, and Mike Pence, the vice president, only learned about being dissembled to, if one can be dissembled to, by the national security advisor through the free press. So it wasn't the act itself, public exposure of the act. So it was bizarre. He does not have a successor. And I just think more than anything else, what we're seeing in this administration, Judy, is campaigns are fun. Campaigns are police escorts, they're airplanes, they're crowds, they're balloons, they're bands, a lot of fun. You speak in vague generalities, you get applause for slogans, and then governing comes. And governing is tedious, and it's difficult, and it's time-consuming, and it demands your attention. And policy isn't vague generalities, it's specifics, and it's based on knowledge. And I will say this. This White House is preciously scarce on attention. And I just don't think the president, I think the president at that press conference you talked about really returned to the campaign stage. He wants to do it again Saturday. It's back to the balloons and the bands and the cheers. That's fun.
But meanwhile, David, there are all these this controversy swirling around. What are there, 7 or 8 different investigations going on about whether there's a connection between the Trump campaign and Russia, looking at whether it was campaign officials, whether it was Michael Flynn's talking to the ambassador. I mean, there are some very real concerns out there that are hanging over this administration.
Yeah, there are 3 Russia scandals all at once. To me, the most significant is the contacts the administration or the Trump campaign may have had with Russian intelligence during the campaign. And so we know they did have contacts. We don't know the content of those contacts. If there is collaboration, if there is some sort of quotation suggesting they got tipped off about some of the leaks or something else, that would be a cataclysmic scandal, and it would just rock the whole administration. My instinct, talking to people in the intelligence community, is that there probably is no great quote showing Paul Manafort getting a specific tip-off from the Russians, because we would already have it by now. There are so many intelligence officials leaking to my newspaper and the Washington Post, they probably would have leaked it. I don't have any inside New York Times information about that, but that would be just a momentous scandal. And that's just, like, that was 4 days ago, and we've almost forgotten it. But there's a whole series of scandals ratcheting it up on the administration.
Is it possible, Mark, the press, all of us are making too much of all this Russia concern?
It is, Judy, but the only 2 entities and news sources that deny Russia's involvement and malicious involvement in the election of a United States president in an attempt to influence the outcome appear to be Vladimir Putin's Russia and Donald Trump, who calls this a Russia ruse. And I do not have inside information on what went on. But I mean, there was there's enough here at this point that I think it puts the Republicans in Congress in a terribly defensive crouch.
David, you started out with some pretty strong language describing the news conference. I wrote down, you said the president came across as mildly deranged. Did you really mean that?
I'll walk that back a little. Unmoored. Is that walking it back? I don't know. It was, you know, if we were not, it's just he's not coherently speaking as a president should, who's going to be carefully giving orders, who's going to be uniting the American people. He is speaking as someone who's involved in a junior high school gladiatorial attack on the press. And parts were bizarre and somewhat offensive, picking on an African-American reporter and assuming she knew people in the Congressional Black Caucus, because I guess all African-American people are supposed to know each other. You know, that offensive. But then the attack on the press, highlighted by the tweets today, saying the my newspaper, NBC, all these organizations are enemies of the people. Well, if you want to draw rhetoric straight out of the fascist playbook, enemies of the woke, the people, that is like, that has so many historical echoes, it's illiberal and offensive to the way democracy is supposed to work and how one is supposed to just act within the institutions of democracy. So within that context, I think some strong language to me is merited.
But, Mark, I mean, Donald Trump was critical of the press throughout the campaign, and he won. So the American people, and we heard William Brangham talking to voters in Texas who have completely different views of which parts of the news media they listen to. Yep. Could this be a winning strategy on the president's part?
I don't think so. Judy, he ran against Hillary Clinton. That was his opponent. And the tough thing about a campaign being over is you lose your enemy. I mean, President Barack Obama, at this point in his presidency in 2009, was on his way already to having passed the bailout, the economic bailout, to pass the equal pay. He was on the way to health care. This is the time you build coalitions. Donald Trump is spending his time, his energy, at precious time, and just creating these new enemies are trying to look for a villain like Hillary Clinton was that he could run against. He needs that as an organizing principle. Without an organizing principle of an enemy, the press is a punching bag. It's unpopular. Yes, it doesn't approach the sense of villainy that he's looking for. And I just don't think it'll wash long term as a political strategy.
David, do you think that's what he's doing? And do you agree with Mark? It's not going to work in the long run?
Well, I think it offends 65 or 70% of the American people, but as we just saw from Texas, it pleases 35% of the people, and so I think he can hang along with that 35% of the people for a good long time. And you know, I've been asking around Republicans on the Hill, are they worried? And personally, they're worried, but there will be no distance between Republicans on the Hill and Donald Trump anytime soon. Among Republicans, according to a Pew poll, 82% of Republicans right now support Donald Trump, which is higher than supported Reagan at this time in his administration. And so Republicans like the guy. 35% of Americans see this, and they say, yeah, way to go. So it will not be a majority coalition. It will not be a governing coalition. But he will retain, if he continues that this way, some solid base of support.
Let me disagree just a little with David. What Republicans have going against them is history. Jody, when a sitting president, has his job rating in the Gallup poll, his approval rating, drop below 50%, then that president's party loses an average of 37 seats in the House of Representatives in the next midterm election. When a president's above 50%, they lose an average of 14 seats. All right. By the end of this year, the 1st of January, Republicans are going to be looking. Donald Trump's at 35. This is his honeymoon. This is
Gallup poll.
Gallup poll has it 38. He's at that point now, and it's hard to see how he goes higher without some international crisis that galvanized totally national unanimity. January, his window of opportunity to pass something big, and these are difficult, tricky, complicated issues he's trying to write legislation for, is between now and December. By the 1st of January, members of the party on the Hill start thinking about themselves, and do they have to establish independence from an unpopular person in the White House? They've got to think about getting reelected.
10 seconds, David. It sounds like the clock is ticking.
Yeah, but they're living in a hermetically sealed Republican universe just as Democrats are, and so they're responding to their own universe, even if it leads to electoral downfall, as Mark suggests.
Okay, David Brooks, Mark Shields, thank you both.
Thank you, Judy. We'll be right back.
And this is CPR Metro. Let's see here. CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio. And my name is Bernard White. The name of this program is Wake Up Call.
360 degrees, and as new worlds emerge, stay alert, stay aware, watch the eagle, watch the bear. Earthquake and foundation shaking, bias breaking, new day making change. Accumulating, liberating, educating, stimulating change. Tomorrow was born yesterday. From inside the rib or the people cage, the era of our first blood stage was blotted or erased or TV screened and defaced. Remember, there's a revolution going on in the world. One blood of early morning revolved to the one idea of our tomorrow. Homeboy, hold on. Now more than ever, all the family must come together. Ideas of freedom and harmony, great civilization, yesterday, but today will bring tomorrow. Neon, Leon, fast lane, brother, you were yesterday when dreams of karma and life still live. As it was in the beginning, so shall it be once again. Earthquake and foundation shaking, investigating yesterday. I was wondering about our yesterdays and digging through the rubble. And to say the least, somebody went to a hell of a lot of trouble to make sure that when we look things up, we wouldn't fare too well, and we would come up with totally unreliable pictures of ourselves. But I've compiled what few facts I could, I mean such as they are, to see if we could get a little bit of light. This is what I got so far. First, white folks discovered Africa and claimed it fair and square. Cecil Rhodes couldn't have been robbing nobody, because hell, there wasn't nobody there. White folks brought all the civilization, wasn't none around. How could these folks be civilized when wasn't nobody writing nothing down? And to prove all their suspicions, well, didn't have to wait too long. They discovered there were whole tribes of people in plain sight with no clothes on. That's right. The women, the men, the young, and the old righteous folks covered their eyes. And no time was spent considering their crime. And hell no, this just wasn't civilized. Another way they knew the folks were backwards, or at least this is how we were taught, is that unlike the civilized people of Europe, these tribal groups actually fought. And yes, there were some rather crude implements, and yes, there was primitive art. And yes, they were masters of hunting and fishing, courtesy came from the heart. And yes, there were medicines, love, and religion, intertribal communication by drum. But no paper and pencils and other utensils, and these folks never even heard of a gun. So this is why the colonies came, to stabilize the land. The Dark Continent had copper and gold, and the discoverers had a plan. They would discover all the places with promise, and didn't need no leases or deeds. Then they'd appoint people to make everything legal, to sanction slavery and greed. And when the natives got restless deep in the jungle, they would call it guerrilla attack. And never described that folks finally got wise and decided that they would fight back. Still, we are victims of word games. Semantics is always a bitch. Places once called underdeveloped are now called mineral rich. And still, we are constantly hounded with unity just beyond reach. Egypt and Libya used to be in Africa. They've been moved to the Middle East. There are examples galore, I assure you, but if interpreting was left up to me, I would swear every time this version ain't mine. That's why it's called His Story. Earth shaking, foundation quaking, bias breaking, new day making change.
A little bit smaller every day. Brothers around the world
teaches college. Do you see much in the way of Black history being made part of the curriculum, or is it an elective as opposed to being a required?
Well, you have Black History Month. What do you people want? I think it's a notion. I think Black history and the studying of Black history is sort of like a notion. Wouldn't that be nice? What if we did? What if we did have Black history and we studied it? I don't believe that it is taken seriously in terms of curriculum materials. And in fact, I think it's avoided. Most places I go, they just don't see the relevance of it. You know, again, it's something like I had a recent experience at the opening of the visitor center at the African burial ground. You realize that those bones rewrote history. They really did. Because they told on us. In the sense that, you know, when we think of enslavement or slavery, you think about the South, those people in the South. All 13 colonies had slavery, including New York. And so are they going to change the textbooks to be reflective of that? Or are they going to say, oh, yeah, and by the way, there's a burial ground, as though it is a separate experience, an anomaly that we don't have to take any real focus on? Do you see what I'm saying? If you look at that burial ground, you learn how we lived and how we died, which is not recorded in the halls of universities, you see. So that requires that we take that information and then infuse it into education. And if you're asking me if they're going to do that, certainly not. Even the information we knew prior to that has not been infused. It's not been infused. The whole period of enslavement, the Middle Passage, the Walk of Sorrow, the numbers that died en route to the slave castles. Do you think they're going to infuse that into our curriculum materials? Or that we are going to insist that it happen?
There are those who say, well, let's put that behind us. That was in the olden days, and things are different now. Look, you even have an African-American as president.
Yeah,
so
also,
let's put that behind us.
Also hear stuff like, and what about Oprah? and what about all those athletes? See? And what you have to do, you know, and again, I guess sometimes people respond emotionally. I don't. I kind of respond very pragmatically to that. And I ask them, with the advent of the election of a Black president, if you will, did somehow the overrepresentation of African Americans and Latinos in the criminal justice system, did they go away? Did it even decrease? As a result of the advent of this great historical moment, has there been a change in health disparities, in the poverty index? Has there been, do you see what I'm saying? So it's almost like a nonsensical thing to say to me, because those institutions that have historically been racist and biased and oppressive continue. The federal government said it twice themselves. They said, oh yeah, we've oppressed you for a long time during enslavement. We oppressed you after enslavement, hence Jim Crow, and we continue to oppress you. That's why they apologized. However, it was an apology that was empty because it had no meat to it. So yeah, we oppressed you before. We're going to oppress you some more, and we're going to try not to oppress you as badly. But essentially, there's no meat to it. There's no... There's nothing to suggest that change has happened. And so I think for people who want to quickly put it behind them, let's get to that point. We don't need to look at that. And I've looked at that phenomenon. Why don't you leave? They don't tell anyone else to do that. They don't tell Jews, just forget about that Holocaust. Don't speak about it anymore. It's just useless and it's ridiculous. Don't, you know, just why even? They don't do that. You certainly are going to tell Asian people to do that. Why do they tell us to do it? And I'll tell you my assessment of why that is. Because when we pull back the covers on us, we pull back the covers on other folks. So we rewrite European history as well. We rewrite our perceptions of those founding fathers and our perception of our inherent humanity, our willingness to embrace and our inclusivity, as it were. Somehow it throws a rock into that glass house, and you begin to realize that things weren't as they were written in the text. not just about you, that black person, but about you, that white person. That's where the rubber meets the road. And we're not getting ready to let Timmy and Lil Sue find out what folks were really about and what they really did. That's where you're going to see the resistance and the pushback, because it's not about you seeing you. It's about everyone seeing everyone.
Before coming here to spend an hour talking to young students in technology, young black students in technology at the Stevens Institute in Technology in New Jersey. And I spent a great deal of time, far more than I normally do, speaking of the modern period. I have spoken at great length on blacks in science. I have dealt with the Egyptian period, with the Moorish period, and with science in other parts of Africa, in the north, in the east, in the south, and in the west. This evening, I want to give you some idea, before I do enter the study of African science, to give you some idea of what is happening in the modern world. Because I am very surprised. I am speaking now to many societies of engineers and scientists in various parts of this country, and I'm very surprised that the modern period is so obscure, that few of them are really aware of the profound contribution that blacks have made and are making in this country itself. In spite of the tremendous disadvantages that blacks suffered, by the year 1913, 1,000 black Americans patented inventions in this country. Now that is a minor miracle, because it was impossible for some slaves who had actually invented things to patent them. In the middle of the 19th century, the Attorney General of this country, Jeremiah Black, what a curious name, said, passed a law making it impossible for a black slave to patent an invention. He said that a patent was an agreement between a government and its citizen, and black slaves were not citizens. And that was the end of that. And that is the reason why some of the early inventions, like the cotton gin, for example, which was a black invention, was patented under the name of a white. But in spite of these disadvantages, as I say, by 1913, 1,000 inventions were patented by black Americans. It included every area of science in this country. I had an opportunity to visit Bell Laboratories in the early 1980s, and I had an opportunity to visit NASA and study what blacks were doing in space science. And I will touch on some of the major scientists I met and talked with in those places. But let me just give you a general view of some of the extraordinary achievements of blacks in the 19th and 20th century here in America. The most remarkable, perhaps, is Louis Latimer. I've often spoken of the light. All of us are aware that Edison pioneered in the electric light, and we leave it at that. Few of us are aware that the light could not have become cheap and practical and universal and used in common homes were it not for the black scientist Louis Latimer. Louis Latimer invented the carbon filament that enabled that light to burn cheaply for thousands of hours. Edison could not do this. And Latimer is the man who actually lit New York. He supervised the lighting of New York. He also supervised the lighting of London at a time when London was the main city in Europe. He also supervised the lighting of Philadelphia. But Latimer was not only restricted to the electric light. True it is that he wrote the standard work on incandescent electric lighting, but he was the man who drew the telephone. Alexander Bell needed someone, a fine draftsman, who could translate his ideas on paper. And it was Latimer, the very man who made light practical throughout the world. It was Latimer who drew the telephone, the Bell telephone, for the first time in order to get it patented by Alexander Bell. I must make mention of Elijah McCoy. Many of us have heard of the real McCoy without realizing that McCoy was black. Elijah McCoy was the first person to invent a steam engine with automatic drip cup. In other words, machinery could then lubricate itself. This was a major breakthrough in the machine industry. We have two West Indians who came to America who did remarkable things, like Norbert Reilly, black West Indian, who invented the process for taking cane juice and transforming it into white sugar crystals. Most of us do not realize that white sugar was the invention of a black man. And that invention, by the way, simple as it seems, was to transform the economies of the two great industrial powers in Europe at the time, England and France. Because the Caribbean sugar became gold to them when you could have a machine that could transform it in the cane juice into sugar. The other one was Jan Matsalega. Matsalega also came out of the West Indies and was naturalized here in America. He invented the shoe lasting machine. It was a laborious task to produce a shoe. It was Jan Matsalega who produced the machine, created the machine that could mass produce shoes. Guess what it was called? The niggerhead machine. We have black American scientists like Granville Woods, who is responsible for many inventions, and one of them that is most memorable is the induction telegraphy in trains, which enabled trains to communicate with each other. Frederick Jones, who made a movable refrigeration unit for the trucks in this country, transformed the food industry, because before Frederick Jones's invention, there was refrigeration in this country, but it wasn't portable refrigeration, hence you couldn't put it in trucks. And before that, they would have these large crude ice blocks, and when the ice block melted, the food went to waste. It was Frederick Jones who transformed the food transport industry in this country. One is also aware of Louis Temple, who transformed the whaling industry in the world by inventing a very clever type of harpoon known as the toggle, which saved thousands of lives and brought us thousands of more whales. Otis Boykin invented something, a control unit, which is used in almost all heart stimulators. He also invented an electrical device, which is used today in all guided missiles and IBM computers. Then there is Garrett Morgan, the man who invented the automatic stoplight. We see it all over the world regulating traffic, red, green, and orange. That was invented by a black. The range of things is quite remarkable, and I cannot deal with them all. I can only give you some highlights to whet your appetite. I had a chance also to visit Bell Labs, particularly in New Jersey. Bell Labs is the largest private research facility in the world. By 1982, it had 1,000 black scientists. Black scientists in New Jersey made breakthroughs. Now, there are many others that I don't know about. I just went into the New Jersey installations. I had a chance to meet Brian Jackson. Brian Jackson invented a computer and gave it the vision and thought processes of a human. It was able to inscribe minute circular marks on chips, precisely one over the other, in less than a second. This it could do. No human being could do that. It gave it a vision that was superior to that of a human being looking through a microscope. There's Robert Ingram. All these are people working at Bell Labs in New Jersey. Robert Ingram was the first person to pioneer in the global memory. As many of you know, when a computer, you have a computer, and then a better computer is invented later on with a bigger memory, he created the control and address wires so that you could have a global memory, so that instead of it becoming obsolescent or outdated, all you did was to add memory to the computer. Then there's Bill Northover. Bill Northover has revolutionized our understanding of glass. He is the man who has made it possible to take glass and to stretch it from 4 feet to 6 miles. Glass fiber. And you can now put information, you could code information on pulses of laser light and transport it through the core of strands of glass thin as human hair as a result of the work of Northover. And we have Thomas Cannon, also in Bell Labs in New Jersey, who created the mathematical equations that enables us to tell precisely the nature of the glass, the kind of stress it can take, when it is pulled, when it is bent, when any stress is put on it, how much it could take, what would happen to it if such and such stress was put into it. He actually went onto the streets of Chicago when Bell Telephones was laying the first light guide cables. Then comes Al Richardson, who wrote the textbook on the laying of cables under the oceans. He invented a laser alarm which can let you know immediately if there are any damaging twists of glass, because the glass has to be spun off from a bobbin into certain casings, and his laser alarm can tell you instantly, stop, something is going wrong, and they can set it right. So just within that small state, you have many of these scientists. James West, whom I had a chance to meet. James West is very famous throughout the world. He's the co-inventor of something called foil electrics. It's a kind of permanent magnet. It is used in portable tape recorders throughout the world. It is used in hearing aids. It is used in various things in which you can translate electrical energy. You can translate sound into electrical signals. And there's a marvelous picture of him in the Guinness Book of Records in the world's quietest room. He has little microphones. He's invented small, very small, like your thumb, stuck in his ear, almost like bits of rubber, very smaller than the thumb, in fact. And he could hear a pin drop in a vast area. But the most exciting thing, because many of these things, like the Bell Lab experiments, I'm aware of them, but I don't fully understand how they operate. The thing that has always fascinated me most is space. And I had an opportunity in the early 1980s to go and spend some time at NASA to see what blacks were doing in space science. As a result of the work I did with Curtis Graves there and writing the first essay on blacks in space science, NASA invited me to witness the first blast off of the first black American into space. So I was flown in a military aircraft from Teterboro, New Jersey to Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, and then on to Cape Kennedy, where they usually send off the spaceships. Now, this was a very extraordinary experience, because the day before the blast-off of the shuttle, this was in 1983, the day before the first black American was sent up into space, all the scientists who came to speak to us were black. I had a chance, therefore, to meet many of the astronauts. Well, not many, because there aren't that many, but I had an opportunity to meet all the astronauts who were on base at the time. Not Bluford, who was being sent up in space, because they have to quarantine them before they go up into space. They can't hang around the place. But I had a chance to meet what I considered to be the most extraordinary of the astronauts, Colonel Gregory. Colonel Gregory is the leading technical astronaut in our space team. Some of you have never even heard of him. He's the first black to pilot a spaceship. He didn't just go up. He was the pilot. They didn't make as much fuss about him as Christa McAuliffe, of course. But he is very important, because this is the man who was chosen to redesign the cockpit of the space shuttle. The shuttles, most of the shuttles were redesigned by him. Now, don't blame him for what happened the last time, because it wasn't the cockpit that caused that blow up. The Challenger exploded, killing the 7 astronauts, because the engineers made it quite clear that that seal could not stand that kind of pressure in that kind of cold. The managers refused to listen to the engineers. They just pushed the engineers' report aside, because they were so concerned by getting a lot of stuff done very fast. So they didn't give a damn about the lives of those astronauts. So when that seal broke, That the engineers were not surprised, and that is one of the most astonishing things, because we thought for a long time that they didn't know what hit them. But that is not true. We have discovered, and I'm sure some of you have heard, that the pilot said, uh-oh, that has come true on the black box, and we find that one of the astronauts was struggling to help the other astronauts to tighten the seatbelt, which means that those guys dropped out of the sky for about 9 miles knowing they were going to die. I mean, that is a horrible thought, because, I mean, you've been in airplanes. The airplane doesn't go very far up. That machine, even just after blast off, goes very far up. And to plunge through the sky knowing you're going to be smashed to bits, because they were literally, parts of their bodies were turned almost into dust. The shock of that thing is really quite incredible. And I remember the day before the shuttle was sent up, listening to the many of these scientists, getting a chance to meet them. I had an opportunity to meet the Hispanic woman, Dr. Patricia Cowens. She is from Brooklyn. Dr. Long, the black scientist. They are leading figures in the space medicine program. Space medicine is a new science, and it's a very important science. Space is very exciting, because when you go up in space, you can walk on the air. You've heard of Christ walking on water. You can actually walk on the air. You can somersault without... You could somersault in the air. You could swim in the air. You can't fall because you have lost weight. The reason why we have weight is because we are nailed to this planet by gravity. If we lose that weight, we fly off into space, because we're living on a ball that is spinning. We're living on a spinning ball in the sky. It's not something that is grounded anywhere. It's spinning in the sky. And that has peculiar consequences when you go up, because nothing has weight. It means that your blood sometimes floats freely. So that you could be standing like this and your blood starts to float up from your leg right up into your head. You have to develop all sorts of exercises. Sometimes these people suffer from extraordinary nausea. In the beginning, some of them had to learn to walk again. They lost the connection with Earth gravity. And one of them, in fact, I think either committed suicide or kept falling over, or he never recovered his balance in the very early stages of space experiment. Now, space medicine, therefore, has become tremendously important. And one of the things that Cowens and Long developed is a special machine. It's called a quantification of yoga. It enables an astronaut, and eventually it will be used by many of us, to train in 6 weeks to tell the heart, go down or go up, to tell your blood pressure, go down or go up instantly. In other words, the kind of commands we have over our muscles, which is so central to Western types of exercises, that's the kind of command we eventually learn to have over our involuntary nervous and muscular systems. I had a chance also, I had lunch with Christine Darden. Christine Darden is the most important black woman at NASA. She is in charge of hypersonic and supersonic research. She has done more than anyone else to reduce the problem of sonic boom. Sonic boom is something that happens as we go faster and faster. Sound is only travels for about 686 miles per hour. This is very, very slow. We now fly faster than the speed of sound. But we will be able to fly several times the speed of sound in the 1990s. We have bombers that fly much, much faster than sound. In fact, we have bombers that fly faster than bullets. One of the astonishing things the Americans discovered is that when they saw the Russian MiG in Korea and they tried to shoot it, they found the plane flew faster than the bullet. So by the time you got a beam in it and you fired, it wasn't there. It had moved. But as we fly faster, all sorts of problems occur. Waves coming from the wings of the airplane create a great bubble. And that bubble explodes, shattering eardrums and windows for miles around. That is sonic boom factor. Well, Christine Darden has altered the nose and wings of airplanes to crinkle the bubble so that we can escape sonic boom problem. But as I say, Gregory excited me because Gregory had invented something. He, in fact, has flown about 105 experimental aircraft, and he invented something which interests me tremendously because I spend most of my life in airplanes. I don't like it anymore. You know, I always get the feeling that I'm going up for the last time, or that I'm coming down for the last and final time. And I used to enjoy it quite a lot until, first of all, I was saved from the crash that occurred in Chicago, the one where the engine fell off the thing, because the plane that was to link me up with the Chicago plane, I missed that because my son, who was a baby, he tied the laces of my shoes. So I missed that one. So I said to myself, there's nothing to worry about. I have a protector. I didn't get into that one, so I'm not going to get into any. So we were flying into Flint, Michigan one February, and it was snowing. And I love snow because I never saw snow until I was 24. So I was very excited about that. And we were going down, and we were almost on the tops of the trees, and everything was absolutely white, a beautiful white snow. And I felt very merry because snow is associated with Christmas in my mind, when we have our artificial snow on the Christmas tree in the Caribbean. And we were coming down, and suddenly the plane made a violent lunge upwards, and everybody screamed, and the captain just came in very quietly. You heard his voice, "Sorry about that, we just couldn't see the runway." And as I have said before, that thing frightened the hell out of me, because I really did not know he had to see that runway, because that's an incredible machine. That machine weighs about a quarter to half a million pounds, and you bringing down this fantastic machine, and there's snow all over the place, you could hardly see a thing, and this guy has to look down and find out where he's going to put this machine. You know, I didn't realize that. I thought it was all worked out, it's all computerized. Because nowadays, every time that thing is going down, I'm beginning to wonder what is in his eye. How is he looking down there? Well, Gregory has taken that kind of risk out, because Gregory's invented what is known as the micro-instrumentation landing system. It's a computerized thing that locks the plane from the ground and brings it down, just like how you have automatic pilots at cruise speed. You know, when you're cruising, all the pilots could leave the cabin. You don't have to fly the plane, they could walk about, and the plane will fly itself because it's on a level cruise speed. But coming down and going up is very difficult. And he's invented something that will bring that plane down on a point of a pin, whether the pilot is dead, blind, or drunk. So I found that extremely interesting. But what surprised me more than anything was to find that the camera, the most advanced space camera of its time, the camera that was taken to the moon, the first camera that was taken to the moon, the camera that took this planet from the shadow of the moon, was invented by a young black, Dr. George Carruthers, the ultraviolet ray spectrograph. And that the leading black at NASA, Major Gillam IV, was the man who supervised and coordinated all the work of our scientists in this country. He was the director of the Dryden Flight Research Center, coordinated the work of our scientists in this country and oversaw the work of the space shuttle from babyhood to blastoff. I found Anthony Trustee, a young black in New Jersey. This boy is 18 years old, from a high school in New Jersey. He was the first person to send an ant colony into space. When he did this with his friends, Because the cargo bay of the space shuttle takes lots of experiments. You have to buy space to carry up your experiment. And some industrial companies in New Jersey gave money when they saw the interest of these students. They gave money to take a piece of the cargo bay to send up the ant colony. That changed the attitude of lots of people in that school. There were only 2% committed to science. After that, there were about 50% of that school went into science. And several of those young people now are on the way to becoming scientists. The remarkable thing, too, was that one of the people who won the first prize in this country for an experiment in space is a black boy, not Trusty, another black boy, who dealt with the problem of ice on the wings of airplanes, how to clear ice effectively from the wings of airplanes. Some of you remember that terrible accident of the Air Florida jet. It was standing there in the ice, the snow was coming down, and they cleaned it, and they left 45 minutes to stand in the ice, in the snowstorm, without cleaning it again. And these stupid, overconfident pilots, they were all laughing when the plane started to go down. The plane trembled and came down on the ground. I came pretty close to it about 2 weeks ago in Chicago. I was coming from San Diego and he had to stop in Chicago. And it wasn't snowing, but it was very cold, and I don't know if that affected the engine, but we were racing down the runway, and just about 3 seconds before takeoff, the engine on the left side went out. Now, that you can't do at takeoff. I mean, you could do that in air, because you could still come down with the rest of the engines, but at takeoff, if the left engine goes out, the plane is going to crash. But the pilots were very fast. As soon as they heard that peculiar sound and they knew that the left engine came out, they brought the plane down instantly. Just as it was about to take off into the sky, they pulled brakes and brought the plane down. And then they told us they're going into the hangar, would we wait? Well, most of the people left. Well, I sat there and I said to myself, this thing can't happen twice. So I stayed. Because I said statistically the plane can't crash twice. I mean, either I'm going or I'm not going. If I didn't go, I'm not going. So I stayed on. But the space experience was a tremendous experience, because when eventually we got onto the Florida flats, hell broke loose. NASA didn't tell us it would rain. I thought it would be a big amphitheater. We'd sit very comfortably there and we'd look out and see the spaceship take off. But it wasn't like that at all. It was a dark night. We were bundled out of buses in the middle of the desert at 2 o'clock in the morning, and rain came down. I mean, real rain, not drizzles, buckets. I mean, real rain came down. When I say real rain, I remember the Caribbean, when the sky really breaks open and the whole thing comes down, like if God is having a bath. And we were standing there and there's lightning and thunder and so forth, but we were so excited because the spaceship is something incredible. You cannot see a spaceship on television. It doesn't look like that. That television camera is 5.5 miles away. That spaceship, it's like looking at the Empire State Building about to take off. It's standing there with lights and billowing smoke, illuminated smoke coming down. It's like if you're on another planet. Because that machine, the engines, there's just a little thing that is going up, but the engines are much larger than the thing they're sending up, because you have to create about 1 million pound thrust to get off of this planet. You've never flown more than about 700 to 800 miles per hour, but you have to travel at 24,000 miles per hour to leave this planet. because the gravity that holds you, locks you to the ground is so great that a plane cannot leave the planet. The plane can only fly in the clouds. A plane can't break through because something still holds the plane back down to the earth. But that ship has to break out of the lock of the planet. And that is an incredible thing to do. So we were standing there waiting, and they start this great countdown over the desert. You hear this voice, like some bodiless thing floating across the desert. And they stopped the countdown at 20. And we stood there waiting. The rain stopped. And there was a little red helicopter floating around above, checking on various things. And then they said they found a valve, something wrong with the valve. But could you imagine that? 20 seconds to go, and some little valve among the million things in that spaceship goes off. They correct it, they start the countdown again, stop, something else wrong. You begin to wonder what's going to happen. Here am I, not very far from the spaceship, and if that thing blows up, I wonder what's going to happen to me. And you know, I mean, I immediately begin to look around to see who I'm going to dive under. And they start to count again, and they stop at 10. And then they tell us that once they start to count again, they can't stop regardless of what happens. The computers have taken over. That's the last time. Man cannot stop that machine because the computers have taken over. So we all get very excited and we start shouting 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. When we hit 0, the most incredible sound I have ever heard in my life burst out of the earth. It was like 100 bombs bursting. It was like if the earth had split in two because a tremendous fire burst in the desert. The shock of that explosion, the incredible explosion to send that ship up out into the clouds away from this planet. And they say that 500 square yards from that ship, everything dies instantly. Every bird, every worm, every fly, every insect is split apart. The shock bursts the organism. The shock is so great. And I felt my blood run from my legs right up into the ear. I felt my blood bubble in my ears. I felt this blood running up and bubbling in my ears. And then came a blinding light. It was about 2:40 in the morning. The spaceship was supposed to leave at 2:30. 10 minutes delay, the spaceship left at 2:40. A blinding light that runs about 700 miles in every direction onto Atlanta, onto the Bahamas. They say you could read a newspaper for 3 minutes by the flash of that light. And off it went, and you see the great fire over the desert, and you see this machine rising slowly, and then it bends over as if it's about to fall, and then it goes up into the sky with Guy Bluford, who was to install the INSAT satellite, and the rest of the crew, and off it went. And then we saw the great booster rockets falling slowly back into the Atlantic. I also had a chance to meet one of the black scientists who worked on the atomic bomb. 6 black scientists worked on the atomic bomb. One of them was Dr. Lloyd Quarterman, whom I met in Chicago. He was dying, though he didn't want to admit it. He had a strong voice, explosive laughter. Even though he was dying, he still behaved with the energy and vitality of a boy. And one of the things I noticed in trying to tape my interview with him is that I just could not get that tape recorder to work. It would whistle. And I said, Dr. Quarterman, are you sure? Don't you have something around you or something coming out of you that's affecting my tape recorder? Because I have a good tape recorder. It always works. He showed me there was nothing, but I discovered afterwards he had something in his heart. But I don't know if it was that that was affecting my tape recorder or if it was radiation, because he claimed that he didn't have any radiation sickness, that he'd worked all of this time in radiation, but he had no radiation sickness. I don't know if that was true. But I do remember in that interview saying to him, people will ask me afterwards, how could you, a man with your noble motives and your honesty, because you have been extremely honest. You have used a lot of your time, even now as an old man, you've used a lot of your time to speak about science to kids in Chicago, black disadvantaged kids in Chicago. How could you work on the atomic bomb? And he says, that's a foolish question, because I worked on something that was critical to the atomic bomb, but I also worked, while I worked on the Einstein in New York, I worked on the Enrico Fermi in Chicago. So I was working on the atomic bomb, as five other black scientists, he said. He said there were six of us. Those were his words. But he said that on the Enrico Fermi in Chicago, they worked on the splitting of the atom for peaceful purposes. And it was on the strength of his work that they set up the first nuclear reactor in this country at Oak Ridge, so that there is a balance. He said to me, you cannot imagine the sense of power I have felt at times, in spite of everything, the sense of power I felt at times, knowing that I'm an extension of God. I've been able to take structures that God has built and change them. Where I find substances that had two molecules, I've been able to take one molecule out. I've been able to put in another molecule. I've been able to change it around. I've created compounds that never existed in the universe. There were two gases, like, for example, argon and another gas, xenon, I think it was, called noble gases, which could never mix with other gases. Quaternion's team was the first in the world to mix those gases which were unmixable. So he spoke of all this work, and one of the things he spoke of with sadness was synthetic blood. He had actually started to build, to do work on synthetic blood, and the monies were taken away from him. We don't know why. He said it was politics. But eventually the Japanese, a few years ago, developed synthetic blood. It's still in its early stages, but Quarterman could have done that, but he wasn't given the chance. There's a whole range, as I say. I've only given you highlights, but there's a vast range of black scientists who've been involved in the science of our time. The first open heart surgery in this country was performed by a black man. The first, as many of you know, blood plasma by Charles Drew. You know of those things we take for granted. But there's a range of other things. The first person to pioneer in taking gas and turning it into the same sort of energy units as electricity is Gurdin, Meredith Gurdin, a black man. He was in charge of electro-gas conversion systems. But let me go back now in time to the African thing. And today, because we have very little time, I'm not going to deal with Egyptian, which I will in my final lecture in December. I will touch on the African origin of Egyptian civilization. I will deal with Egyptian science and its impact on Greece and the ancient world. The area that I want to touch on tonight, in the time that I have, is the Moorish thing, because that is the profoundest scientific impact on the world before the Industrial Revolution. Many of us take it for granted that the Industrial Revolution was purely a European thing. That was the result of European genius, that we were able to transform the world from a sort of peasant, rural, agricultural world into an industrial world. Few of us are aware that at the time of the Moorish march into Europe, Europe was in a kind of dark age. The Greek glory had faded. Borrowed glory too, because only part of it was European. A great deal of it had an Egyptian base. Roman glory had faded, and Europe was in a dark age. Then came Muhammad. Muhammad brought fire into the belly of the Arabs. Muhammad, like Jesus, was not particularly liked by the people among whom he grew. For example, as we well know, Jesus was executed because he had aroused the ire, the wrath, the anger of the Jewish high priest. Many things that Jesus did annoyed and outraged the high priest. because Jesus picked up the whip in the church and decided to cleanse it by throwing the money changers out. That was not forgiven. That is the reason why when Pontius Pilate, when Jesus was brought before Pontius Pilate, because the Romans then did not realize the significance of what was going on, because they didn't know enough about what the Jews, why the Jews hated Christ, why they wanted him executed, because Pontius Pilate said, look, I've examined this man and found him innocent. There is Barabbas. He want Barabbas. No, 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 we don't want Barabbas. We want Jesus. Because he challenged the high priest. So the fact that Jesus was a Jew didn't make him loved by the Jews of that time. The common people saw the remarkable power and beauty and magic coming out of this man, because that was the supreme consciousness made divine. It was like divinity made man. That was the highest level of consciousness that had ever been seen in the world. But he made enemies, and that is why he was executed. The same thing was true of Muhammad, in a lesser sense or in a greater sense, depending on your commitment. Muhammad was chased out. His followers had to flee into Ethiopia, because you must remember that when Muhammad rose, the Arabs were not in any highly advanced state. They were warring tribes. Some of them were attracted to Muhammad because they felt that they could enter crusades for territory, carrying the religion, etc. Some of them were attracted by other things. But after the death of Muhammad, the Arab thing the Muslim thing became very powerful. It sent Arabian types into various parts of the world. They went up into India, they went up into China, they went down into Africa. Many of them intermarried with Africans. Now, there is a period in Arabian history, very, very early Arabian history, long before Muhammad, in which the Arabian Peninsula is purely black. Then comes a movement of peoples into that Arabian Peninsula, so that at the time of Muhammad, although there were black Arabs, they were a minority. This began to change, however, when the Arabs went into Africa. Because as they went down into Africa, they started intermarrying with African women. And when the thrust was made in 711 AD, taking Africans and Arabian types into Europe, it is estimated that of an army of 7,000, about 6,000 at least were black Africans. They went up there and they established the first dynasty. This was the Umayyad dynasty. The Umayyad dynasty, however, didn't last very long in its first phase, because big fighting broke out after Muhammad's death between two factions of Muslims. And these factions began to fight. And so even when they advanced and took over part of Europe, Portugal and Spain, the Sunnis eventually attacked the Umayyad dynasty, and they murdered the royal family while they were on holiday in Damascus, and the Umayyad dynasty collapsed, and then came the Abbasid dynasty. Then the Umayyad dynasty was re-established by a man called Abdurrahman. Now, the important thing to understand, there were four Muslim dynasties in Europe. The last two were overwhelmingly black. The first two included major black contingents, but the last two were overwhelmingly black dynasties. That is the Almoravid dynasty and the Almohade dynasty. These were founded in Western Africa, along the Senegal River and other places. Now, it's very important to understand that when the blacks and the Arabian types charged into Europe, Europe was in a mess. It did not have what we see today. We take for granted all this was once a proper sequence going on, and you find that you have Europe advancing upwards. Europe wasn't advancing. Europe was going down. Its mathematics was inferior to African mathematics in the best places, Arab mathematics, and mathematics in certain parts of India and China. Its science was not on a high level. the kinds of things that came out of European universities was appalling. Europe had only two universities. The Muslims introduced 17 universities into Europe. Every major document, particularly scientific documents, out of early Egypt, out of Greece, where many things had been borrowed from Egypt, out of Rome, out of Persia, out of China, out of India, was taken into Europe, into those universities, and taught in Arabic. Not only that, Europe was 99% illiterate. 99%, only a certain class of people read and wrote. This was true in various parts of the world. Africa had scripts. Africans wrote. Africans had the Mande script. They had the Afaka script. They had the Akan script. They had the Meroitic script. They had once had the hieroglyphic script. Europe only had a few scripts too. Very few Europeans had scripts. The English had no script. We assume that this is it. This is not English script. The English had never invented the script. They only had sounds. Blacks in science, that's a sound, which is Anglo-Saxon. But the script is not English, because the English have no script. This is Roman script. Only Romans had script, Greeks had script. Celts had a script which is partly African. The Phoenicians had a script which is partly African. The Russians had a script. Only a few Europeans had scripts. 99% of them, as I say, were illiterate. The introduction of science on a high level into Europe came under the Moors. The Moors introduced the first lighted streets in Europe. The first paved streets in Europe were introduced by the Moors. Air conditioning was introduced by the Moors. And it was a special kind of air conditioning. They led their thing over the flowers, so they had perfumed air conditioning, which none of us seem to have. In addition to that, algebra was introduced into Europe by the Moors. Algebra, in fact, is an Arab word. Geometry had come out of Egypt, into Greece, into Rome, and then came into Europe, into other parts of Europe, that is, because Greece and Rome is in Europe, it came into other parts of Europe. The first people to take water from the mountains and run it down into the homes were the Moors, the blacks and the Arabs, not the Europeans. This is in Europe, you know. The first hot and cold water system in Europe was introduced by the Moors. Many industries, plants, fruit were taken from the rest of the world and introduced where the Moors built their civilization. It is not an accident, therefore, that it was Spain and Portugal where the Moors had ruled from 711 AD until about 1250 AD. They also went on right up to 1492, but in a restricted area, Granada. When the Moors were defeated at Granada in 1492, who do you think surrendered? I have seen in a book, when I was traveling last February, this same year, I was invited by scientists to an island called Plum Island. It's the only island, the only agricultural research unit in the United States where they study exotic diseases coming from the rest of the world. And I was taken in a ferry with these scientists to their lab so that I could speak about various aspects of African science. And on the boat, somebody opened the book and started to show me Moorish architecture. And I said, I know about Moorish architecture, but I'm not terribly interested in that because I can't tell what aspect of it is the Arab thing and what aspect of it is really the true indigenous African thing. Show me faces. I want to see faces. And he took out a picture in the middle of the book, a beautiful painting of the Moors surrendering. And who do you think was surrendering? Black people. This is in Europe. In 1492, the year Columbus sailed, the generals who were surrendering Granada were black. But if they weren't surrendering, if they were conquering, they would have white faces. But because they're surrendering, they allow them to be black. That's weird, you know. Because I saw that with Charlotte Young. I read a book by Charlotte Young. She's an English woman on the Moors. And all the time they had blue eyes and fair skins and straight noses. But as soon as they start to give them licks, they turn black. She says, the frightful was the slaughtered Africans. Where did they come from? They were all fair when they were on top. As soon as they start to give them the blows, they turn black. Note, the psychology of racism is incredible. Absolutely incredible. You go to these scientific institutions and you're trying to find out what blacks did. The first thing they tell you, science is neither white nor black. I know that. But when you go, when I go and I see young scientists, they don't even have a foggiest idea of what their people did, because they suppose science to be white and black. And yet, many of our kids are afraid to go into science. We don't have mathematical capacity. Then we have a long tradition, a continuity of people who invented geometry. Long before Pythagoras, they have the Pythagorean theorem. You find Archimedes. This area of the curved, the curvature of a circle or something like that, you find the exact equation long before he announces it, 1700 years before. You can find it in the mathematical papyri. Yet if it doesn't matter, you see, that's the first thing they tell you. As soon as you start proving your point, what does it matter? What does it matter whether you're black or white? But when they're taking that fact to keep our kids dumb and make them feel dumb, it matters. It matters. The hell it matters. Our education is affected by it. Our capacities, our potential is affected by it. I saw the experiment with fleas. You know, a flea jumps about 2 feet off the ground, a normal flea. You know, they have fleas they put in a box. It's only 6 inches high. And then they let the poor flea out. And he's seeing his friends jumping 2 feet. No, man, I'm not jumping 2 feet. I'm a 6-inch flea. That's where the black is. Conditioned to jump 6 inches. And you're going to tell me it doesn't matter? That's, many of our kids are conditioned to jump 6 inches while other people are jumping 2 feet. Even when you give them freedom. It's like what Farrakhan said, they gave you freedom and you didn't even take a walk. So we have to become aware of these things, because unless you go back to those traditions, unless you go back to that historical thread, unless you are aware of that particular kind of continuity, you always believe you're starting from scratch. That is one of the things that used to fill me with such horror when I was in England. I would hear things even from my younger brother. We have to start from scratch. We never did anything. Let's face it, we have to start from scratch. When in fact the real truth of the matter was that the Greeks were starting from scratch. The Egyptians had done many things when the Greeks struck them. NASA informed me, and I have it in this book, Blacks in Science, which you must get. You must read Blacks in Science. There's a picture in here of an African aeroplane. It's the only aeroplane ever invented in the world before the Wright brothers. It's 300 years before Christ. It doesn't have an engine. We don't know what kind of power it had. But it actually got off the ground and flew. It was a glider, they say. It was a glider. They probably took it from High Point and they brought it over a gorge or something like that. But we have found prototypes of this at Saqqara, because the Egyptians built models of everything, every ship. We have found their ship under the pyramid, an enormous ship. Do you know what is extraordinary about this ship? It has about 200 pieces. And they would take it apart. and put it back together again. Do you know what that is? Could you do that with the Queen Mary? They not only mastered the building of this ship, they did it so well that it was in pieces. You could take the pieces apart and put them back together like a jigsaw puzzle. A real big ship, you know. So our forefathers had reached states of excellence that are quite extraordinary, and we have to become aware of that, because you must have models. You can't look around you at the broken, shattered, fractured world and use that as a model. You have to go back into history, which is still real, because it is that distorted, it's a distorted vision of history that has made our oppression real. People who... And if that distorted vision made our oppression real, it is only through a healthy, new, objective vision that we can make our history different. We can't redeem the living present without redeeming the past. That is the reason why we have to be connected, as I have said again and again. What happened 10,000 years ago and happened 10 minutes ago occupies the same time, space, and consciousness. Flesh passes and moves, but the mind is still there. And all the illness of those centuries is still with us in varying forms. Because even though we are free today, we are not really free. I mean, I could say, I couldn't 100 years ago, perhaps even 50 years, I couldn't say to hell with Ronald Reagan. I could stand here and say, to hell with Ronald Reagan. What the hell does that matter? Right? Reagan is still in charge. So I have freedom to shout at him. It's like, remind me when I was in England, we had a little spot. There was one little corner in the whole empire where you could get up and say anything you like. The hell with the Queen! And the policeman would walk around and smile at you because he know that don't mean nothing. You could talk until you blew in the face. The Queen is in power. When we begin to go beyond protest,
yes, sir,
and enter a state of consciousness that is truly revolutionary, where we really question the ground of this civilization,
yes, sir,
the false ground upon which it is built, then it is more than saying, to hell with Ronald Reagan. We begin to plant into that system ideas, a different consciousness in our youth, that is going to really blast that kind of mentality to hell. Because that is what we need. Let me return to the Moorish thing, because it is amazing how in our study of European civilization in the universities, you hear so little about what the Moors did. Hear so little about what the Muslims did. And yet that was absolutely vital to the Industrial Revolution. Even the guns which were to conquer the African and American continent was not invented by Europeans. They have found fire sticks used by the Arabs in India. Gunpowder was taken out of China, and the chemistry of gunpowder was already developed among the Africans in Egypt, though they were using it for another purposes, just like Waterman. In Chicago, they were using atom splitting for one thing. In New York, they were using it for something else. So the fact that the Africans had gunpowder didn't mean that they would end up with the gun, but the Arabs used the gun, not the Europeans. The Europeans stole the gun, because those things were taken by the Moors into Europe. Gunpowder was taken into China. The fire sticks were taken into Europe. Even numbers. Numbers are very important. Ciphers, that is to have ciphers for 1 for 1, 2 for 2, 3 for 3. Those are Hindu. All of us use them today. It's universal, but that was taken out of India by the Muslims. The Europeans did not have numbers. The Romans had X10, which is a letter. XI 11, XII 12, XIII, and they go down the road, and when they meet 100 C, then M, then XCMII, XCMVII. It's all letters, clumsy, cumbersome. You can't go very far in science doing that kind of thing. But they like to tell us, you look, you, when I was in England, the first thing, the thing that was kept telling me again and again, how we are preliterate people. The African is preliterate. You know, I didn't know then the English were preliterate, that they didn't have a script. They never invented a script.
Tears, sorrow and sadness here, but there's heaven and sunshine too. The spirit of peace moves free and clear, making way for laughter here. There are children that flower the trees. There are voices of people who believe in this place.
Okay, that's it for today. This has been Wake Up Call on Radio Justice. I've been your host, Bernard White. I hope you enjoyed our reach back into the Wake Up Call archives. And until next time, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
Place, yeah.